This is the executive officer panel discussion. We'll go from now until 12 o'clock. At 12 o'clock, we have a buffet luncheon in the vendor area, a wonderful buffet provided by the Venetian Hotel, which I'm sure you will like. So this is the what used to be called the CEO roundup is now called the executive officer panel discussion. The rules of the, let me introduce our panelists. To my far left, I have a substitute for Dr. Hauck, and that's Mark Hoffman from Cerner. And Mark is the head of the Translational Medicine Unit of Cerner. To my immediate left is Dave Hickey from Siemens. His bio is in your booklet. To my far right is Gilbert Hakim, also a substitute for Paula Page, who could not make it today, and Gilbert has agreed at the last minute to come and participate. Gilbert is known to, I'm sure, most of you and has been on these panel discussions before. And to my immediate right is Mark Spencer of McKesson. Now, this is what we're going to do. No one is going to flog any of their products. This is a strategic discussion of the challenges facing healthcare, laboratory information, computing, pathology, informatics. I've prepared a list of questions. My preference is not to use my questions, but to use your questions about strategy. So what I'm putting out to you that is that if you have issues that you would like this panel to discuss, please proceed to the microphones. We'll take your questions. Please, rather than give speeches, I would prefer questions. And I will equitably arrange the responses across my four panel members. Everything is fair game. If we don't have questions from the audience, we can revert to my questions, and I'm very capable and willing to do that. I prefer to pursue your interests. So with that opening, I would invite you to the microphones. Fair game. You can ask these gentlemen anything you want. There's probably 100 years of experience in this panel about the lab industry and lab software. So I would invite you to come to the microphones. If there are no initial questions, I can launch the discussion. Does anyone have any questions? Well, let me start a question. Dr. Belice has a question.
This is a general question to all the panelists and to you, Bruce, as well. Customer relation modules, CRM, are certainly emerging in many fields besides healthcare, of course, healthcare at large. And recognizing that the laboratory industry has unique requirements for customer relations, I'm wondering just what the current thought processes, in fact, zeitgeist is of development of CRM for LIS, and you know, both things that you're doing now and things that are on the horizon.
Gilbert, why don't we start with you? Gilbert's very shy. I'm hoping sometime he'll come out of his shell. So we really have to prod him to give us his opinion about things. So we'll start off. It's appropriate to start off with Gilbert.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Generally, CRMs is a multi-purpose application that is used from sales point of view to basically collection of materials, specimens, to courier tracking systems, to basically inventory modules and supply management, and so on and so forth. There are very few people in that specific market, generally, short of course, the big boys like Siebel, Oracle, SAS, and there are many of those vendors that operate in the high end of the market. A few years ago, actually, we produced an application called Courier Tracking System, which does all of those things in terms of managing the sample from collection point of view at doctors' offices and basically keeping track of the drivers where they are and so on and so forth. And those products are in beta site right now. But the interesting part about this type of application is that it's very in flux. So you can't really code them in a traditional basically flow which is hard coded. And what we used is basically we developed a workflow engine, which is Java-based HTML workflow engine that allows the end user basically to create those business logic without any code change. So that's why it's very difficult to penetrate that specific market because of its nature itself and rules or criteria of requirement in customer relationship changes, and your application has to change with it without code change, basically.
Any other panelists that are interested in? Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
We actually believe, and I do in studying the industry, that actually your business is actually going to change from traditionally, as Gilbert stated, managing supplies to your customers, the physician. With the future of consumer-directed testing, with the future of genetic and genomic and pharmacogenomics, you're going to, as a business, provide a more extensive service and more complex service. So the ability to create a call center so that as you produce those results and provide those to physicians, the phone's going to start to ring. And how are you going to manage the information and the ability to help and consult with your customers, the physicians? And as consumers start to directly access in your test catalogs, how are you going to answer the phone when a consumer calls? So what we've done and what we do at McKesson, we have a call center. Ask a Nurse is the concept that was born in McKesson, and we actually believe the next one will be Ask a Pathologist.
Mark, who are the customers of the laboratories? Do we have a clear, Mark has talked about physicians and consumers. And do you see that the range and scope of our customers is going to increase? Our CEOs and CIOs, customers of the lab?
I agree that they are. I would also add that an additional market is the clinical trials arena, where labs are increasingly realizing that supporting research is and also an open opportunity for them, and that that's also a client of the lab.
Okay. Let me go ahead. I'm sorry,
just,
Dave.
Just, you know, one other comment as well. I think, you know, when you look at even IVD vendors like ourselves, you know, we actually have a lot of CRM applications in the way we operate on an operational basis, you know, every day. So we have relationships with SAP and Siebel and people like that. And, you know, it may not be something that we organically would develop in terms of modules that could help the labs, but could we then leverage our relationship with our vendors to try and bring value add into your arena?
Mark, you raised a very interesting question about the labs and research projects. Obviously, this is a specialized industry that is lab support for controlled clinical trials. You have some global players such as Covance and Charles River. Do you think it's possible that, say, a large hospital lab could even compete in this space? Do you have an opinion about that?
I would say that it is a very active market, but to the extent that the home institution is participating in clinical trials, the ability of the labs to ensure that the data that they're generating complies with all of the regulatory guidelines stipulated by the FDA and other regulatory organizations is an important aspect of considerations for development in order to ensure that, at minimum, supporting ongoing trials work within your institution, whether or not you try to actively compete with those large labs.
Gilbert, I know at one point I think you were approached by a CRO. I can't remember whatever happened to that. Do you ever hear from CROs in terms of LIS support?
Generally, actually many of our sites, especially teaching hospitals, are all doing that. They just segregate a certain portion of the database, try to basically make sure it's secure and nobody else can look at it, and they use the existing LIS to do that. We have even some of our IDNs, which is a commercial lab that is servicing multi-hospitals, have gone into that market. And apparently, it's a very lucrative business. So we have at least 10 to 15 of our sites are doing this, generally, as far as providing clinical trials type of service in general.
I don't want to get distracted by this, but it's a fascinating topic. A lot of controlled trials are going offshore. and essentially a Covance has started, at least what they describe as the world's largest global laboratory network, particularly in Asia and India. And there are some fascinating aspects of this network, including the requirement to normalize the data. That is to say, coming up with the same reference lab across instruments and across different countries. I don't want to get distracted, but it's something that's fascinating. Yes, Dennis.
And, Dr. Friedman, you've mentioned and presented several times the concept of the diagnostic systems, the diagnostic information system. And I guess basically all of your panelists have companies that provide multiple disciplinary type systems. And one of the questions I would have for in general for all of them is their perception of the future directions encompassing, as you've pointed out, lab radiology, but also cardiovascular, cardiology, that those types of applications and other domains that relate to diagnostic medicine. Where do they see themselves going?
It's a fantastic question, and I just did a blog note about Philips, which was a bit of a laggard, clearly a power in the imaging world. They just bought a British CVIS, cardiovascular information system. So, Dennis, your question is wonderful. Let's start with Dave Hickey. He hasn't said anything. He's got a stake in this, I would say. And so let's hear from him to start off with.
I think it's a central part of a strategy going forward. I think for me, you know, and listening to Bruce's talk yesterday, you know, a lot of dialogue around the potential for DIS, diagnostic information systems. I think that my personal perspective is I think the trend to actually get that and to get to the integration of systems itself between the two disparate departments of radiology and pathology is probably going to be slow. I think what's more important is the actual integration of the clinical information. So I think it's really, and you're absolutely right, Dennis, I think at a workflow level, if you, you know, because if you think about it, you're starting to look at disease state medicine now. Cardiology, oncology, neuroscience, where really diagnostic insight, whether it comes from an imaging modality or whether it comes from a lab modality, integration of that data is key. So I think that'll be the first driver, rather than actually developing a new product that is a DIS. I think that will come over time. And I think some of the drivers for that will be perhaps, you know, people who have responsibility over both radiology and pathology in terms of managing those disciplines, where they may see value in driving sort of, you know, single source vendor.
Mark Hoffman.
I would say that some of the steps we're taking towards a more integrated diagnostic vision and strategy is within the laboratory, rather than taking approach that enhances the use of silos between laboratory divisions. We're actually working to create core technologies that work across our capabilities. So rather than a heme path report requiring clinical pathology here, flow cytometry here, we're using a very integrated approach. And we believe that positions us then for the broader integration across other diagnostic disciplines. So instead of having a pathology imaging strategy and a radiology imaging strategy, a centralized consistent imaging strategy is a key step towards positioning towards that.
Do you have any discussion on that?
Actually, we pose that to our own customers in their business. Do they see, and in fact, I asked the question to our strategic advisory board on Monday, do they see the blend or the merge of radiology and pathology? And unanimously, they said it would not occur, although they could be managed administratively, the two disciplines will still remain separated. What needs to be integrated is the information. And enabling a pathology information system, which includes APCP, to be enterprise aware. I actually am an advocate of a federated model, the ability for the information system to be accessed by a radiology department, where today it's a closed, all LISs are closed systems. So the ability to open up the systems, I think, is definitely going to be required in order for that to occur.
Gilbert, do you want to comment on a DIS?
Yeah, generally, if you go into a genetics information system, which is basically a byproduct of the imaging systems and ability to really look deeper and deeper into the cell, And they're similar in PAC system and radiology imaging. That's where really the information is in terms of these images and definitions. And radiologist obviously has to communicate with the pathologist and the geneticist as well. So that's really where the common denominator of the information is. So what ends up happening, obviously, last 5 years we've been developing genetics information system, which includes cytogenetics, molecular flow cytometry, HLA, you have biochemistry, and so on and so forth, which is necessary actually to look at other areas to create a biobanking database environment that you can keep tissues, bones, other material, and the images related to that that crosses different population and basically has the ability to provide one cross basically specimen view from many different basically discipline, from PAXIN radiology to cytogenetics, and even connected to the basically pharmacy type information to be able to provide some sort of a overall diagnosis for the patient and basically personalized medicine.
Gilbert, what are the challenges of, from a technical point of view, of this mixture of images and text and numerical data? Do you just view data as data, or do you have to have a different mindset to do this integration and storage and retrieval?
Right. This is a very interesting question, because the size of these images that has to be DICOM compliant is so large. And then most of the networked systems in the hospital are not really designed to deal with this massive amount of information and images generally. So from a diagnostic point of view, you need to create a separate, probably, network which is deals with pre-diagnosis basically repository. This is not stuff that you really show the patients or doctor on the floor. You need to have a repository of the information which goes across multi-disciplines that are solely for the scientists and the pathologists to really review and render a diagnosis or something that is basically understandable by the physician that is ordering this type of diagnosis.
Dave, what's your position on cloud computing for PACS support? Do you think that's the future, or from a corporate point of view, would you rather have those images on site, or do you not care?
I think, from an educational perspective, a learning perspective, I think that's the trend. I actually think, you know, from a hosting perspective, from a cloud perspective, I think, you know, radiology is already going that way with many of the vendors. And I actually see a lot of the laboratory images and anatomic pathology images just doing exactly the same.
Mark, in terms of the volume of data, I think about this a lot, genomics, proteomics, and that's your area. How do you see this evolving? Clearly, not all LISs can accommodate this volume of data. The retrieval's complicated if you want to get down to genomic data. On the other hand, community hospitals are going to require this. Some LISs can't accommodate to it, in fact, and most EMRs have difficulty in terms of reporting out complex genomic proteomic data. This is not going to slow down. It will accelerate. What's your vision of the future in terms of hospital LIS management of complex genomic and proteomic data?
Certainly. I actually think that considerably more important than the image aspect of genomic data is the discrete data perspective, because mining that data in order to do discovery, using data for clinical decision support, all of that relies on discrete data. Most genetics labs today are using anatomic pathology reports in a text format, which is largely unmineable, especially for genetics and cytogenetics text reports. So creating a discrete data strategy is a major part of supporting the high volume discrete data generated by CGH arrays and other microarray type activities. It's been very interesting that there's a lot of hype about SNP arrays and so forth for a long time, but CGH arrays have come up really from the side and blasted into actual clinical practice much more rapidly and thoroughly than we see with other microarray technologies. And we believe that by having a very well-defined discrete data strategy that's based on a vocabulary that we've developed, and tying back to the earlier conversation, we've actually released that into the open source through the NCI Meta Thesaurus. And so by engaging in activities that promote the use of discrete data, we think that's really a very important element of supporting high-density data.
Question in the back.
In regards to middleware, after the very exciting lecture we had yesterday, the value of that seems obvious to me, and some of it looks pretty exciting. But the question I have is, how can middleware play nice with the big boy LIS, or would you guys just sort of wish they went away, or would you buy them out?
Great question. I'll address that to the whole panelists. Why don't we start with Gilbert, and then we'll work across.
Generally, functionality that exists in the middleware is really designed to basically make a decision based on the result that just arrived from a specific instrument. This type of obviously decision-making process is limited because the data that is kept in the middleware is limited. So if you're looking for toxic pregnancy by looking at a specific data that came from a specific instrument, and the prior result that is in the middleware, obviously you're not going to have 9 months worth of data in the middleware environment. So you can't make those decisions with the middleware environment. And they don't cross multiple middlewares either. So they don't cross chemistry to hematology, hematology to something else. So repositories or large LISs have enormous amount of information that for disease tracking purposes or finding a particular problem, the LIS database is much richer, and ability to really decide or direct the technologies to do one function or another is much, much better. So the question really is that whether you can embed this particular type of function within the LIS or not. And in our case, we already have been doing this for at least last 10 years. So in our environment, most of the connection that we have to middleware technologies is a pass-through environment. So we receive all information from instruments, whether it's QC data or scatograms or whatever it is, we just basically use them as a pass-through. So we can actually apply rules across all basically instrument results and history of the patient.
I'm a customer. We actually use and have a very strategic partner on data innovations for middleware, and I'm a very big proponent and advocate for what they do very well, which is help manage the manufacturing of a result inside of a laboratory. As automation, islands of automation are blooming every day. Actually, I probably see a trend where total lab automation is going to be able to need to connect those islands of information and automation. And we see data innovations being the experts in that area. Where we provide expertise are on two sides. Clinical performance, providing you the decision support tools so that when the result is seen holistically across the clinical profile, we provide the expert rules and decision making for pathologist clinicians. And then the other side of it, we manage in our LIS, and what we do well is manage the financial performance of the laboratory, the billing aspects, the reimbursement, the adjudication of the claim before you receive the order. So what the middleware does is manage the manufacturing. We manage the clinical performance and financial performance.
So Dave will be interesting because Dave, essentially, Siemens has a wide array of responsibility, and I'd be interested to hear what his middleware responses.
Yeah, I mean, being in a company that not only has LIS and middleware, but also HIS and instruments, we have to make everything play nice, right? So And I think, to me, you know, thinking about Gilbert's comment, it is around functionality. But it's interesting. I think what you've got to do is take a step back and actually have a look at, you know, the sort of what is the question or the issue that we're trying to help the customer solve. And I think what's been really intriguing for me over the last couple of days is, and thinking back on previous on summits, is there's been much more dialogue now around workflow. You know, previously it was data integration, data management, and we've evolved to discussions around informatics in terms of workflow resolution. So I think for me the question is, it's functionality. And if you look at it from instrument software, middleware, LIS, HIS, just making strategic decisions on content as to what has got to lie where, and then once you've done that, make sure you get sort of total interoperability between the systems. And you know, that's clearly a strategy that we're focused on. I think what is also interesting, though, is if you look at it from the vendors that are just niche middleware, of course, you know, they will try and drive incremental functionality in the middleware to sort of maybe replace gaps or pain points in LIS. And I think you'll maybe see some overlap then between the roles and functionality of LIS and middleware, depending upon vendor source.
Mark?
I think if you look at examples like HIV TrueGene, where there's a very complex interpretive algorithm that they've developed, their investment is not something that we want to duplicate. We do want to, and are actively doing this, pull the output from their analytical engine and then bring the patient-specific relevant information into their either lab record or directly into their EMR. And then within the EMR, that data can be used for decision support to manage their prescriptions and so forth. The role of middleware, you know, does enough middleware add up to an LIS? I think there's still the posting some of that information to a site that will manage the versions and manage corrections and so forth is fundamental. And where that occurs is clearly an open topic of discussion. But I think that there is a definite place for middleware, and we've got multiple strategies for how to incorporate and integrate with them.
I'm very interested in a number of comments, one of which was Mark's comment about collaborating with data innovations. And I've been in this field long enough to know that we've now transitioned to the sort of monolithic LIS vendor, the Cerners, the Softs, and so forth. And now we're much more open to essentially integration across modules within the LIS space. And as Yul pointed out yesterday, he talked about his federated model as it applies to the LIS world. That is grafting on with the federated federated architecture modules that either your current LIS vendor can't supply or whose module is inadequate in your perspective. This then takes me very quickly to the notion of a system integrator. In fact, there have been system integrators at the level of the hospital EMRs for a long time because many of those systems were difficult to implement. We have not had many system integrators in the lab world. And I'm just wondering now if we'll see more system integrators if, in fact, Yule's idea about federated architecture in the LIS world, either we're going to have system integrators or the vendors will take upon themselves the responsibility to integrate foreign modules. So the question is, what would be the incentive for that for them to do that? Are you going to provide them with financial incentives to do that, or do they do that out of the goodness of their heart to retain you as a customer? So this whole notion of system integration, I think we're at a tipping point from the monolithic LIS to a much more open architecture, and I'm pleased that we're talking about open source, and Yule's references to AP middleware opens up that discussion. Yule, you want to comment on that?
Just very briefly, since federation has been brought up yesterday multiple times, and in fact will be covered tomorrow in a sort of a 1-2 punch of order entry and then results generation, I'll just throw a general question to everyone. How do we get there from here, where there is this holy grail of having true plug-and-play interoperability? You know, the analogy people use is the hairdryer or phone that a consumer purchases, and you take it home, and you really don't worry about it working. And what a wonderful world it would be if we had a user community and vendor community partnered solution where everything, in fact, were in fact plug and play. And obviously, we can't get there all at once. But what is the current set of thoughts of where your individual corporations are for getting towards that goal? And certainly, there'll be opportunities tomorrow to have a more detailed dialogue on that as well. But I think that this is on the thought of a lot of individuals' minds, because sustainability is becoming increasingly complex in the setting of this growing plurality of interfaces, which are very, very hard to support.
Gilbert, we'll start with you and we'll work across the whole panel to respond to Yule's question.
Sure. Actually, this definition of the word middleware actually has different meaning to different people in different technologies in general. In actually IT, middleware has completely different definition than what we call it in the LIS environment. Actually, it's a layer that goes on top of the TCP/IP that manages intercommunication of the client with the server. That's what's called middleware in the IT department. Middleware in general, obviously, is used in different terms. LIS vendors, including us, we do not want to get involved in the basically interpretation of the result that comes from the instrument, because that falls into the category of the basically device, classified device that has to go through FDA, and it causes an enormous amount of problems. So those middleware areas, even in, for example, cytogenetics or molecular, these are cottage industries that people keep these formulas to their chest and they would not divulge it, and they create these middlewares that LIS vendors have to connect to that, because we do not want to really get involved in class 2 device in general. So those middleware technologies or devices or PCs that do interpretation, the actual statistical interpretation of the results, will be there for, and LIS vendors will not try to really go after that market generally. So that's really the second layer. Really relates to flow of, which, again, the definition, current definition of middleware is that regulating flow across few instruments that are connected to a particular box. So the middleware name is used in that context as well. And that is really a physical connection. Robotics vendors are going into that market of providing that middleware that connects multi-instruments. So the vendors that are strictly in the middleware software are facing this challenge from the instrument vendors that are basically entering that market in general. So to us, basically, that looks like an instrument that is sending result to us. But in our environment, that segment which relates to the flow change obviously is limiting when you're dealing with middleware in the usage of basically flow change or verification between two or three instruments. Because in our environment, the new generation of technology that we use allows actually dynamically merging instruments based on time of the day of the week. So, for example, if you say that between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m. in a small laboratory, I have 15 instruments and one tech in there, obviously, if you receive stat samples with 15 tubes, you drop them in 15 different instruments, you don't want to go into five different middlewares to release them. In our environment, based on time of the day, you can say between 4 o'clock and 9 o'clock, I want all these 20 instruments to go to one screen. So practically, you can, through CORBA application, merge basically these outputs and present it to the user as one, basically, workstation, one instrument. So this is the advantage of this type of technology, which is called multi-threaded. It is multi-threaded. That means that it can connect to multiple instruments and present a common view. And you can change this model based on time of the day of the week, or even remotely. If you have a remote laboratory and for whatever reason there are few people missing today, you can remotely verify those instruments because you can create a variable combination of these instruments and present it to the user as a single instrument. So this is really what definitions within this middleware technology. Some is solidified, and Elias Wender would never go in there, which is interpretation. And the other segment, which relates to the flow, which can be easily done in the LIS in much more complex and much easier environment for the end user, saving enormous amount of labor and increased productivity generally.
I'll try to answer a little more quickly. Actually, you bring up a great point of we're in our fourth generation of laboratory information systems, fourth decade. I've been in it 25 years, and it's changed, and it's going to change even greater in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, I'm not going to give you my history. It's not a 25-year answer. What you really look when you walk into your environments, it's heterogeneous, unless you're a Meditech customer and you got it all from everyone, or you purchased a system of the 80s and 90s, you've made best of breed buying decisions, and you continue, whether it's AP, blood bank, whether it's the transcription system, if you look at whole slide imaging. What you really need to do for a pathologist and a clinician is connect all of the various technologies and emerging disruptive technologies. An example of that, and actually you can see it being demonstrated at our exhibit, Aperio, bringing whole slide imaging to the market, very good at what they do, and the ability for you to launch that Aperio viewer within our application. That interface and that application interface was connected in a weekend. That's how simple it is if you build your applications for an open technology. The ability to link your PACS imaging system and the ability to create a portal to go view it. Pathology doesn't need to have a PACS system. It can link to it. And the ability to see a clinical profile and clinical history. The need for open standards, though, needs to occur in lab. And what McKesson would like to do is lead the industry and challenge people at this table to lead the industry and create the standard. Radiology did it 10, 15 years ago. Why can't pathology do it? So we're also sponsoring API, CAP Foundation grants, and helping the industry lead a standardization and movement towards open systems.
We'll take two more comments, and then I'll get your question in the back. We need to go to Dave.
Yeah, very quick. And again, you know, I think it depends on your own perspective, right? So, you know, for Siemens relative to the plug and play, our primary goal, particularly where you have instrumentation and you know, different networks, is to get the plug and play of our own solution done first. I think, again, each company and each vendor would make their own strategic decisions on openness of architecture. You know, I think certainly it's very important that I think that, you know, the more open you can be, but, you know, from a commercial perspective as well, that you're looking after your own P&L, you know, I think there's still a balance that you can bring to the pathology department. And, you know, coming back to Mark's comment, we did start some work last year, not within pathology standards, but from an industry perspective, to kick off an industry consortium, because I think that it will become much easier if we can drive to standards and standardization. And certainly multiple vendors did get together last year and kick off an industry consortium for driving to standardization. Personally, it's not going at the rate and the pace that I think it should, but we're not giving up on it yet.
Mark, and then we'll take your question in the back.
I think the key to plug and play becoming a reality is standardization. Cerner, Siemens, GE, McKesson, we're all active participants in AHIC, HITSP. I think SNOMED has gaps when it comes to advanced esoteric testing, so filling those gaps, LOINC, and some of the other vocabularies, they're major gaps, and so we're working with them to contribute to closing the holes in the various vocabularies. So outside of the architectural exposure, there are other things that I think are also fundamental to laying the foundation, but I also agree that if you've ever participated in a standards-making body, it is a very slow-going process.
Yes, sir.
Speaking of imaging,
Who is the real end user and what need does it fulfill? I mean, these comparisons between radiology and pathology, and yes, we need DICOM for pathology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in our hospital, for instance, we just got PACS going, and it's wildly successful, not because the radiologists like it, but because the family practice doc can pull up the chest x-ray of the pneumonia. Now, whether the family practice doc knows what he's looking at, that's another story. Whereas in pathology, we went to a digital tumor board, and I did something which I thought was brain dead. I put an arrow on the tumor, and the surgeon came up and said, "Phil, this is wonderful. I've been going to tumor boards for 20 years, and this is the first time I've seen the tumor."
So who's the customer for imaging? We also have to remember the patient as the customer. That is the clinician saying, "This is your lesion or this is your tumor."
Yeah,
most people ignore that.
I mean, the family practice doc, the ENT doc, he's looking at those radiology images and saying, "Hi, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and because of this image, I'm going to do this therapeutic interaction now." Whereas for pathology, number one, I don't think anybody but the pathologists are competent to interpret what they're looking at anyway.
I think you have to be careful about issues relating to competency, but it opens up the whole notion of Nighthawk radiology as well, which is a huge industry. I'll open his question to the whole panel, anyone that is interested.
Actually, if you look at some of the new companies, Access Genetics up in Minnesota, doing molecular diagnostic reads, not even reads, decisions, making diagnostic and diagnosis, via the web. They have a Nighthawk radiology model where they actually have pathologists around the world. And the reason they can do that is because they've linked the customer environment with real time. So they've collected the medication profile. They've collected the current discrete results. They've collected the previous clinical history. And they can actually view an image if necessary. So I think that's actually their state of the art. I think that's the future. And how you enable your service to be consultative, to expand your service as a reference site, you're going to need to take those to enabling technologies and apply them to your own practice.
Any other takers on my panel for this?
I think from a pathology perspective, I would completely agree. From a classical imaging perspective, and outside of ultimately the patient, I don't think there's really one answer, because I think it depends upon the imaging modality. You know, now when you look at things like portable ultrasounds and things like that, you'll have a customer base or a physician base that will benefit out in primary care. If you look at cardiac CT, cardiac MR, and even linked to pathology, disease state medicine in cardiology, it's probably the cardiology specialist within the hospital. So I think it varies.
Any other takers? Gilbert?
Generally, if you follow the samples when it arrives into pathology, anatomic pathology environment, once the layer of imaging is not sufficient, it bounces into molecular. And there where you really need the imaging to supplement what the pathologist has found in terms of reading the slide. And this particular process goes back and forth between molecular and pathology, and integration of these imaging, even, for example, from a PAC system, to be able to review as a consolidated review workstation going across, for example, PACS, anatomic pathology, molecular, helps the scientist and the pathologist to really release, finalize a pathology result, for example, from a molecular module. So this imaging, if you go deeper and deeper into it, it's very helpful, first of all, to know these images comes from the same specimen across from the time that it's collected to the time that goes through across different lab department, and the scientists and pathologists be able to review all of them and make sure that all these images and information comes from the same sample.
Let me go to a slightly controversial topic, and let me set the stage in the following way. If you read the most wildly successful healthcare IT blog, which is his talk, you come away with the impression, first of all, that most of the new EMRs that are being sold to CEOs, CIOs are Epic and Eclipsys. They seem to be dominating the market. But if you read that blog, you also come to understand that there are multiple failures. A high percentage of EMRs either are not installed adequately or never get installed at all, at a loss of hundreds of millions of dollars. I then bring in John Gilbertson's comments about enterprise computing and how, to a certain extent, labs are now being dominated by decisions made in the executive officer suite, away from best of breed. And Hal and Hal talked about, and Dennis talked about, forgetting best of breed, but a CIO, CEO wants to make one buy decisions across a whole suite of software. I guess my question, with this sort of background to the panel, is what's the future of laboratory computing? Are we going to get buffeted around by the executive officers, or can we carve out our own niche, given the fact that lab world is exploding, we're moving toward digital pathology? What does the future hold for us? Let me start with Mark and then walk across the panel.
I don't think they necessarily have to be an or. I think in sites where the EMR and the lab systems can be integrated, there's a lot of novel capabilities that can be accomplished that are not available when they're not. But we also recognize that the independent laboratory, or that the separate, the decision where an EMR is of one supplier versus the lab system another, that the future for that type of hybrid environment is equally bright. And so I don't think it necessarily is an or. I think the parallel direction actually will continue. Certainly we like to see the sites that have both the EMR and the lab system, because we want to enable the really the personalized medicine functionality that can only be provided when you have an EMR that acknowledges some of the novel data from the lab.
I think, you know, if labs were to take a strategy, their own strategy, where they look to just carve out a niche and put up barriers to being part of an integrated system that was enterprise-wide, I think that's a wrong decision. Because, again, if you look at the market and if you look at what's happening from an absolute macro perspective, you know, it is going to enterprise. A lot of the companies are changing or you know, supplementing their distribution channel with C-suite calls, because, you know, when you look at what healthcare's have got to do within the budgets that they've got to do it, it's a bigger healthcare delivery question overall than just what's self-contained in the lab. So I think the labs have got an absolutely vital role to play in it. And I think it's about the attitude and the opportunity for how they embrace and get into the enterprise. You know, you've seen so many presentations over the last couple of days around sort of the educated consumer and patients and now direct access testing. Labs have got a role to play in that, I think.
John had mentioned Gilbertson. He spends a lot of time outside the department liaising with the executive officers. I know Yule is considered an incredible resource by the CIO and the CEO and the director of the hospital. So this stuff is not going to fall in your lap. You have to win that kind of attention and respect. I'm sure these gentlemen will agree with that. Mark, can you continue?
Certainly, from a laboratory perspective, we benefit from the McKesson footprint. But ironically, of the 250 customers that we have today operating our product or currently installing, only 65% of them are best of breed standalone, where no other McKesson product exists. Quite ironic. And the reason why we're successful is we actually enable a laboratory to participate in an enterprise environment, the ability to connect to the Epics, the Siemens, the Cerners, and other systems that exist, and the ability to focus on helping the laboratory actually cost justify and be able to, as Hal and Dennis said, put our money where our bet is in terms of a return on investment and a benefits realization and the ability to go at risk and to go help our customers with the lower cost of ownership and ROI models is why we're successful. From an enterprise perspective, we see a lot of buying where customers are being faced with $350,000, $400,000 upgrade costs for their legacy systems that there are over 2,000 systems that were installed 15 years or later. They're being faced with the challenges, the shortages, and the cost justification. And so what we've done is build business models and economic models to help customers change out and get lower the switching costs and then position their laboratory to be the foundation for the future of personalized medicine and genetic and genomic care.
Gilbert?
Generally, obviously, we're one of the leaders in the market in the LIS, and that's really the only thing we do. And we cover almost every area in the laboratory. We have over 1,200 employees, and we're growing at a 20% pace a year. And we expect this growth to occur for next 3 years. In general, majority of this growth really is fueled by shortages, severe shortages in basically pathology departments, pathologists, scientists in cytogenetics, and lack of basically technologists. So automation is a major driver in terms of replacement market, and of course some sunsetted products overall. But the whole key revolves around justifying basically to the administration where you're adding value and basically either protecting the laboratory from people that you have to hire that are no longer around, because that particular technologist market is shrinking very rapidly, and technicians are aging very rapidly as well, and not too many people are entering that particular market in general. So from a sophistication, and interestingly, even for example, we're talking about molecular, which is seeping into microbiology and biochemistry, which there is a built-in obsolescence that those products that cannot support, for example, molecular in traditional areas like microbiology or biochemistry would be in demand in terms of replacing their system within next 5 years. So there is a healthy growth environment because the science of laboratory is continuously changing, and obviously very large aircraft carriers cannot maneuver as fast as a company like us that are really targeting just the laboratory information system.
We have about 7 minutes left. Let me finish up with this final question. Scott Shreve has talked a lot about consumerism in healthcare and the relevance of that for the lab market. And I would put a question to the four panelists as to consumerism and laboratory information systems. Does this have any relevance for lab professionals? Should they be doing something different? Should our vendors be doing something different in order to allow us to participate in this burgeoning consumerism retail market in the lab world? Mark, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I think it's very important that the lab industry be very vocal about the importance of distinguishing patient-entered information and information that's generated through regulatory-compliant laboratory operations, and that from the supplier perspective, putting a brick wall between that the two types of data is fundamentally important. There are lots of groups trying to poke holes in that wall, and I think being very vocal about the value of the professional laboratorian and their ability to interpret a complex combination of results is fundamentally important, and that from the information system design, that's equally important. So, for example, we do things where we have kids who enter their families of diabetic children who enter their glucometer readings, but that goes into a personal health record, and that's firmly segregated from a glucose reading that's done through a CLIA-compliant lab. And so the two glucose readings are not blended in the patient record. People with appropriate access to both records can view both, but it's very clear how they're distinguished. So I think the consumer is absolutely increasingly well-informed and demanding. If you look at companies like 23andMe, DecodeMe, in genomics, people are, you know, building businesses around a very complex model, and how those companies impacts our domain and our areas is very fundamentally important. So we need to be very vocal about the regulatory perspective on that topic.
So, Dave, consumerism?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, I think there's a role for the laboratory. You know, you've heard of the companies that Mark's just mentioned. I also think, you know, when you look at other groups just outside of the direct patients, you know, a lot of the patient advocate groups today are driving the membership, their own patients to become informed, to demand more. So I think it's about defining and really understanding what the boundaries of the laboratory might be and how you sort of communicate and liaise with the patients directly. I think it's a fantastic opportunity for education, and I think it's a fantastic opportunity for the labs to actually show the value of what they do, just know the boundaries of what you should and shouldn't communicate.
The ability for the laboratory result to be shared across not only a community, but as the patient moves. I'm at McKesson, 95% of all pharmacy transactions in the market are processed through our transaction hub. What we believe is the ability for a pharmacist to be helping to direct therapies. The pharmacist, the retail pharmacist, is going to continue to play a vital role. But a pharmacist is only going to be good at what meds the patient's on, and compliance with the patient. And the only way you really can tell is through a laboratory test and value. And so we believe that you need to link lab and pharmacy for real therapy management to really, you know, be effective. And the ability then to manage diseases. We believe that our laboratory, ability for laboratory to be deployed in testing in the home healthcare environment and consumer-directed testing, be able to manage that. What we believe in disease management as the aging population, we today take on risk of 5-7 states across the country where we manage that risk at-risk population, and we do that by really managing the medication therapies and compliance and then ensuring that we understand the clinical values and lab associated with those patients.
And finally, Gilbert, and then we'll adjourn.
Generally, obviously, a lot of these decisions in terms of what to post on the net, who can access it, with what priority has to do with the culture of the basically system and what is allowed legally and what is protectionism and so on and so forth. So it's a very complex environment, and it's been very slow to really deploy these type of technologies. Where in France, for example, you can have your entire history on a memory stick that is, you can take it to anywhere and they can read it. So, and this is happening today, so it's not rocket science, it's not future stuff. It's the question of basically culture, which the culture of freedom of basically, or security of your data becomes precedence over the actually providing care at the least amount of cost. So this is a major differentiation, which obviously countries with public health care dominating the process can adopt these new technologies much faster than we can in general. But technically, it's highly feasible and it's possible to do that generally without any problem. And to tell you the truth, we did, for example, something 15 years ago. People could actually tap into the LIS because they wanted to know the result of their glucose. They punch in their ID into the Touchstone phone, and system would read back their glucose. And this was done almost 15 years ago. So the technology is there, everything is there, it's achievable, but getting this through the political system and legal system is a different issue.
Thank you so much. I will adjourn this panel. I want to thank all of our panelists for a very stimulating discussion.